Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 71, Burgoyne's Expedition. So when last we left off, we were talking about General John Burgoyne and how he was preparing for the campaign season of 1777. We were bringing everything back to the north. We were discussing how he was planning to use a different tactic. He wanted to move south from Canada, take the Hudson River, cut off the American connection between New England and the other colonies, because New England was kind of, at this point, the greatest source of manpower that they had, along with some naval power, whichever they could muster. A lot of their elected officials are from New England, so there's a big source of power for the revolution in New England itself. And if you take that away from the southern colonies, more of the southern colonies were lukewarm on the idea. New York, New Jersey, as we've seen, South Carolina, Georgia. So these colonies are not huge fans of going to war with England, but they're following New England, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and they want to, you know, follow into the fold. Burgoyne wants to break that. He wants to break this union apart. If he does that, then, oh, look at that. The war will be over quickly. So he assembles his men in Fort St. John on June 13, 1777. They have all the pomp and pageantry that you would find in England, in a major city, with drums and marching and, you know, regimental colors are strung out. The men are in their best uniforms. Everything looks like a real parade. But the strange thing about it is it's in the backwoods of America and Canada. But after they were on their way, Burgoyne pens a letter that he meant to gather loyalists to his cause, although he basically angered a lot of the patriots. He spoke to them negatively, condescending, thinking that it would rally loyalists. Sadly, this is not the first time his writing got him in trouble. Burgoyne also told his Indian allies that they could move against the rebels, but they were to leave the women, children, and elderly alone. So these two things put together are real stopping points for Burgoyne. Remember, he was the one that wrote the letter that angered the Patriots right around the time of Bunker Hill. Now he's telling his Indian allies that you can do whatever you want. Just don't touch the women, the children, and the elderly. Now, as we look back, as historians look back, most people wouldn't find that strange. The reason that it is strange is because Indians fought total war. And when you fight a total war, you are not only fighting soldiers, you're fighting men on the frontiers, backwoodsmen. And not only are you fighting them, but you're going to destroy them and their families. You want them eradicated from your land. And the deal was that if you joined me, Burgoyne says, then you can have your lands. England will ensure your lands. Well, doing that means that they have to get the backwoodsmen that are already there. But if you leave the women, the elderly, then you're leaving people there. You're not holding up to your end of the bargain. More importantly, the children. What happens, and we've seen it 1,000 times, the sword that their father has fallen on has seen a child rise up to use their sword to destroy the tyrant that killed their father. It's a story that is as old as the stories that we've heard from antiquity. Look back to the era of the Roman Empire. Julius Caesar is murdered. Who takes it up? Octavian, his nephew. Octavian takes up the mantle and says, You tried to destroy the Republic by killing my uncle. I will kill you. And he chases down Brutus and Cassius and kills them. If you look at, you know, once again, we're going to refer to the Roman Empire. Alaric, his father is murdered. Attila the Hun, father is murdered. Hannibal, father is murdered. They were all killed. They picked up where their fathers left off. They continued the fight. And the same thing goes on the other side. You can, if we sat down and actually really thought about it, I could pull 16 different examples from history, but I don't know, we don't have time for that. And that's not what this podcast is about. This podcast is talking about the American Revolution. And in this case, taking away that ability from the Indians to fight their total war, to destroy the backwoodsmen, the usurpers that would take their land illegally, according to not only the British government, but the Indians and the laws of themselves, if you leave their children, especially their sons, that's someone else that can rise up and fight them. So now we're going to see that things are going to get a little shaky for Burgoyne and his Indians. Now, Ticonderoga, he's heading there. He knows the American army is there. Ticonderoga itself, and we're going to just review the schematics of it, is on a square peninsula that was about a mile long and 3/4 mile wide. The fort was on the water, but was surrounded by high elevations. One was called Mount Hope, and that was to the northwest. The other one was called Mount Independence to the southeast. These two high grounds rose above the fort. The fort was an old defensive work that was meant to protect the former French colony from invasions from the south. So the big problem is that, well, how are you going to, you know, you're going to use a fort that was meant to protect in the opposite direction. You know, you're going to use a fort that was meant to protect from enemies invading from the south. Well, right now, your enemy's coming from the north. So it's a bit of an awkward situation at that fort, at the fort at this current time, I should say. But the fort was a key junction for Lake Champlain, where it meets Lake George, which eventually connects to the Hudson River. The Americans had set up defenses on Mount Hope and Mount Independence. Even the old French lines behind the fort were fortified. The only one that Gates did not fortify was a mound called Sugarloaf, which was a high ground to the south that he swore was too steep to climb. But yet, Colonel Trumbull and Anthony Wayne are pretty convinced that, well, this can happen, and, well, they actually climbed it themselves, and they said, hey, look, we were able to do it. Heck, even the limping Arnold, who was still recovering from his broken leg, was able to climb up the steepest side. As for the American army, they were supposed to have troops return to camp on June 28th. There were supposed to be 10 Continental regiments, along with 2 more militia regiments. But these regiments were nowhere near full strength. The average was only about 160 men. They have 120 artificers and 250 artillerymen. With those numbers, they would not be able to cover all the defenses. Overall command of the fort was handed over to Major General, I should say, Arthur St. Clair. Now, if you were reading the book, or reading a book, I should say, if you're following along, you're going to see a man with the name Arthur St. Clair, the St. dot Clair, okay? From everything that I've gathered, and I know this might be a question that pops up at some point, from everything that I've gathered, the pronunciation of it that I've, that me and the other park historians of Saratoga have figured out, seems to be more like pronounced Sinclair. So if you're following along, reading something, that's who we're talking about here. So he's placed in overall command of the fort. He joins the Patriot cause in January 1776, and by February the following year, he's made a major general. He's selected by Gates, who is currently running around with Washington's army, to take over commander at Fort Ty. For those who are saying, hey, what about Arnold? Well, Arnold, first off, is a brigadier general, not a major general. One, and two, he still is recovering from a busted leg. So really not the man to be leading the defenses, considering he is still limping around with that issue. Sinclair arrives on June 12, 1777, to a dire situation. Serving under him was Matthias Alexis Roche de Fermoy, a man we've met in the past, John Patterson of Massachusetts, and Enoch Poor of New Hampshire, a brigadier general that is going to be someone we talk about in future episodes. All four of these men were not making much of a name for themselves in the war so far, but, like I said, give it time. They met with Schuyler in Albany on June 20th to discuss the plan for the fort. They all agreed that there was not enough troops to protect the fort, and they are pressed to need coverage on Mount Independence because it was the most defensible position. If they had to escape, then the fleet of bateaux would be made ready for the men-at-arms to use so they can escape down the river. Of course, this is all relative to the fact that they would have to get the men from the fort to Independence and from Independence to the bateaux. So, not the greatest of plans, but it's what they have. While all this is going on June 18th, Burgoyne and his fleet were at Cumberland Head. They had made pretty good time, averaging about 18-20 miles per day on the water. They arrive at Crown Point a few days later. Remember, Crown Point at this point has been deserted. They were going to use this as a springboard for landings around Fort Ticonderoga. And the first was on June 26, General Fraser's advance troops with Indians, Tories, and Canadians were deployed to some areas around Fort Ticonderoga. They would start the setup for what would be the siege of the fort. A few days later, on July 1st, the main army began to move from Crown Point to other areas around the fort. Now remember, the fort is wedged on a spit of land between two lakes on the north and south, but then they have obviously opposite sides that they sit on. The fort, the peninsula, was technically on the western bank. And then there's the eastern bank. Well, the west bank of the lake was going to be taken by the British. They were going to land their troops on that side and set up a siege on the western side of the fort. While the Germans would lay siege to Independence in the eastern side of the fort. Early on the morning of the 2nd, operations against the fort began. General Phillips, who was in command of Fraser's advance guard, moved his troops to Mount Hope. The troops on Mount Hope were outgunned and outmatched, and very far from the support of the fort itself. So, they decided to take it upon themselves to set fire to the works and retreat to the old French lines, somewhere that would be a little bit more defensible. Now, if the British had moved quickly enough, they might have been able to cut off the escaping Americans before they got to the old French lines, but of course, they moved cautiously. And they did not send someone until the early afternoon to occupy the Mount Hope. Captain Fraser, not to be confused with General Fraser, was sent with the Indians and some British marksmen to see if they can round up any stragglers. They found no one. They had all gotten back to the French lines. Like I said, they had sent Fraser, the marksmen, and the Indians earlier in the day when the Americans were like, oh, nope, let's set fire to the works and let's get the heck out of here. They probably could have captured a sizable detachment of men. But they all got back to the old French lines, lucky for them. As they near the old French lines, they run into, well, obviously, pickets. The pickets are out, and a small skirmish breaks out. Sinclair, who's thinking that this is the start of an actual attack, orders that his men hold in the trenches. Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkinson, the man who's commanding the troops in the trenches, orders his men to hold fire. Then he taps one lone marksman to take a shot at a British soldier that got way too close. He orders the sergeant to take this shot at the man. When that shot rang out, there's an eruption of musket and cannon fire. The entire line opened up with volley after volley, along with cannons from the fort. When the officers had finally gotten their men under control in order to cease fire, the British had fallen back out of range of the muskets and cannons. For all the pyrotechnics, one man was killed and two more were wounded. The man that Wilkinson had targeted, which started this whole thing, was actually lying down. He just happened to be unharmed because, well, he had started out the day a little drunk. While all this is going on, on the western side, the Baron von Radazel is moving his men towards Mount Independence. And of course, a small fight breaks out there. And his men are returning fire with the hill is firing down on the Germans, and this goes back and forth. Nothing really comes of it. But when darkness sets in, his men settle into camp, without any moves made towards Independence for that day. On the morning of the 3rd, the British, on their side of the lake, or river, whatever you want to call it, start to move on to Mount Hope. And with the exception of a short cannonade between the two hills, there really isn't any movement on the 3rd. The Germans stayed in camp, they didn't really go anywhere, and they basically just relaxed on the 3rd. The British were in no rush to continue with their siege. But one thing does happen that day that is pivotal, and Burgoyne meets with his chief engineer, a Lieutenant Twiz. He tells him to scout the mount called Sugarloaf. What is it? What's there? Can we use it? The engineer comes back and he says, the hill commands the fort at 1,400 yards. And it's only a mere 1,500 yards to Mount Independence. I could open up a road to the top and have guns placed up there within 24 hours. So, Burgoyne is like, do it. Get the guns up there. Given the green light, General Phillips will take charge. His words are absolutely priceless, in my opinion. And I'm going to take a second to just, you know, offer this up to you guys. If you ever are questioning something, just think back on this quote. The British soldiers have to bring cannons up to a, we'll say, a small mountain or a hill that was about 800 feet high, 700 feet high. If you ever think that something is impossible, just remember this. Where a goat can go, a man can go. And where a man can go, he can drag a gun. Priceless words. Love it. Burgoyne also took Gall's brigade from Radazel in exchange for giving him Captain Fraser's brigade of Indians, Tories, Canadians, and British marksmen. Not Captain Fraser, General Fraser. The Fraser thing is going to be a huge inconvenience because I'm going to be bouncing back and forth for a while before something changes. And it's just going to be going back and forth between Captain General. General Fraser's brigade of Indians, Tories, Canadians, and British marksmen. He wanted Radazel to move to the south side of Mount Independence, cut off the area of retreat, block the river passage to make sure that the Americans can't get to their boats, they can't get off the mount, and everyone is stuck there. The problem was, Radazel was slow to react. And St. Clair, seeing what was about to happen, is expecting has been expecting an attack, decides that it's time to rethink our strategy. And on the morning of July 5th, Sinclair notices that there's movement on the top of Sugarloaf. Not only were there men up there, but they were putting a 12-pound gun. That 12-pound gun would easily lob that 12-pound projectile into the fort, with not really batting much of an eyelash. Sinclair calls a council of war, and it's pretty unanimous between all the commanders in the fort that they're going to abandon their defenses. They can't evacuate in full force because the enemy is hanging around, and they have those Indians who are just waiting for an excuse to draw blood. So he's going to wait for night, and as luck would have it, the night of the 5th was a new moon, which would give the Americans the complete comfort of darkness. Something that they've been definitely benefited by in the past. That's going to do it for this episode. I do apologize for the audio quality. Something is really wrong with my computer, and I don't know what it is. But unfortunately, I don't have the time, the effort, and the energy to sit here and goof around with it to figure out what the heck is going on. So unfortunately, it's going to sound like I'm doing my podcast episode in a tunnel for at least a little while. I'm hoping that I can get it sorted out. Maybe the acoustics in my house are just not working so good, but I don't know. I've sat in this spot of my house before. I don't know what the problem is. Either way, the poor audio quality is completely on me. It has nothing to do with you guys, so I apologize. Secondly, there was a slight delay because I was once again trying to figure out what's going on with my computer. Also, this week was awards week, and one of my seniors received an award, which I was presenting to her, so I was very proud of her, and of course, I was too busy to do a podcast episode that day. I will be putting out this week's episode tomorrow so that I can get everyone caught up, and then Monday, Memorial Day, we will be back on track and talking about, well, you'll find out what we're talking about on Monday when we get there. So I'm going to do an episode today, episode tomorrow, and then we'll be back on track on Monday. So everyone have a great evening, and yeah, till then, keep the powder dry.